You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park.
About the third stop from where I boarded the bus, there were some white people got on and they took all the front seats.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies, not a turn.
It is a violation of human rights when babies are denied food or drowned or suffocated or their spines broken simply because they are born girls.
I'm feeling honored that I'm being chosen to the Nobel Peace Prize.
If you are a black person and live in the black community and walk out on the street every day seeing white policemen surrounding you, and then you ask me whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
The Foreign Secretary about sexual violence and conflict, and Kashmir was not mentioned once. And this is a disgrace, and we consider Kashmir was ignored.
She's gonna learn that this life will hit you hard in the face. Wait for you to get back up just so it can kick you in the stomach. But getting the wind knocked out of you is the only way to remind your lungs how much they like the taste of air.
On a sweltering hot day in July in Tanzania, Mary Leakey left her husband who was sick and recovering from the flu and headed into work. Now, Mary Leakey's office wasn't like any of the other workplaces for women, especially in 1959. She wouldn't have been wearing a skirt or going to answer phones or to type on a typewriter. Her job was a little bit different. Located 45 miles northwest of Ngorongoro Crater, Olduvai, sometimes spelled Oldupai, which is the Maasai name for the wild sisal plant that grows there, is a site that contains sediments interspersed with layers of volcanic ash and lava that date back to over 2 million years. Within these beds, a plethora of plant, animal, and human fossils have been excavated. This is where Mary Leakey left her sick husband and descended into the rocky, dry gorge and began to work on excavating. Just 2 decades earlier, she was a woman with a scarlet letter on her chest and enveloped in scandal. When she met her husband, Louis, who was now sick in his tent, he was already married to someone named Frida Leakey. She was pregnant with a second child. Mary's passion and intelligence for anthropology captivated this charismatic Louis, and he eventually divorced Frida in 1939. Mary and Louis's reputation and funding would be damaged for many years to come. And that series of events would eventually lead them to Kenya. There, in Kenya, they were thrown and embedded into this deep rift of white colonization and violence against the Kikuyu. It would be another decade before they ended up in Olduvai digging in the dirt. Ultimately, they would spend the next 20 years digging through Africa's famed Olduvai Gorge in search of proof of Lewis's pet theory that there was an African origin of human ancestors. Before that, everyone thought that human beings came out of Asia. On that hot day in July of 1959, Mary Leakey would change the world, at least what we knew of the world. Digging in the dirt, she discovered hominid remains that predated any previously found. The breakthrough lent credence to the theory that Africa, not Asia, was actually the cradle of humanity. And it also indicated that humanity had a much more ancient lineage than anyone had previously suspected. Lois dubbed the fossil Zajanthropus boeci. Due to the fossil's suggested brain size, appendages, and evidence of tools used, the fossils were officially recognized as a new species in 1964. In 1986, after its placement in the Homo genus, a new female skeleton was discovered, which allowed for the proportions of the Homo habilis to be recorded. Leakey's discovery, along with this, let us know that habilis's longer arms and shorter legs told us that maybe we had been classifying ancient humans wrong all of this time. It also told us that 3 million years ago, the genus Homo surfaced in Africa. The Homo genus is considered to be the earliest ancestor to humans after, of course, we split from chimpanzees. The Homo genus, given its name to the species Homo habilis, which is considered to be the first species to sort of use stone tools and master the tools, has a name. Homo means man, and habilis means handy. So Homo habilis means handy man. In her career, Mary Leakey discovered 15 new animal species and one new genus. This is huge. She was killing it over there, just discovering things left and right. She was elected a foreign honorary member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1979. Her discoveries were huge. We learned that human evolution isn't a simple linear progression from ape-like hominids to the early humans today. It wasn't like 4 million years ago, your great-great-grandparents were just two chimpanzees having sex who had children, who had children, who had children, who had children. That is not how this works. Early humans moved through several stages of evolution over time. But they were also wanderers who moved all over the different lands. And that led to the different species and ways that we evolved, too. As these different creatures moved and spread out across southern Africa and then up into Europe and into Asia, they start to separate into different bands, and each of those bands continue to evolve, and slowly human beings scatter across the globe. But there are four major words that you need to know to understand how this happens. Homo habilis, which means handyman. Homo erectus, which means upright man. Homo neanderthalensis, which we call Neanderthals, and Homo sapiens, which we consider our ancestors. Let's talk a little bit about Homo habilis for a minute, because they're pretty fabulous. If you look at them, picture a very ape-like creature that is sort of evolving into a mini-human. They're about 3 to 4 feet tall, weighing around 70 pounds, and they could use tools. It was given the name Homo habilis handyman in 1964 because the species was thought to represent the first makers of stone tools. Currently, the oldest stone tools are dated slightly older than the oldest evidence that we have for genus Homo. So we actually have tools that are older than the Homo genus. We do know that the Homo habilis evolved in Africa at a time when traditional foods in the forest, like fruit, started to become scarce. And so the Homo habilis had to seek out nutritional sources. Now, this was a number of things. Environment changes, as you know, people have studied the climates and the world and the continents. We know that weather has changed over time, and we know that land changes over time. And this Homo habilis would have to adapt to survive, and they did. So when fruit in the forest becomes more scarce, Homo habilis starts to eat meat. It's theorized that they start doing this first by scavenging for animal carcasses. Sometimes they would snatch meat right under the noses of predators like lions. They would go in and they would sneak in as a tribe and steal the carcass from a lion. That was a dangerous venture and didn't always work out for them. But luckily for them, the Homo habilis come up with something, because their bodies were no match for lions, but they developed stone tools. They took stone and they developed and they would sharpen them and beat them into crude implements that they could use to smash open animal bones to protect themselves, possibly. And then when they got the bones from a lion that, say, ate all the meat off the carcass, they could smash open the animal bones and extract some really good nutrition from the bone marrow. There was a 1.8 million year old partial skeleton discovered in 1986 that was thought to be female because of her big brain. Just kidding, it was because of her short stature. Dating the sex of the bones are always tricky because the bones are so old. This species was initially considered to be a direct ancestor of modern humans, but fossil discoveries in the mid-1980s show that Homo habilis had really rather ape-like limb proportions. So even though they're starting to develop more human-like features in their face, their bodies are very much like apes. They're using tools like apes. That evidence in the 1980s led to a reassessment of how we view Homo habilis and its relationship to modern humans. Many scientists don't think that this species is one of our direct ancestors anymore, and instead, they consider it a side branch of our family tree. It was thought for a long time that Homo habilis evolved into Homo erectus, and it took about 1.5 million years. But now we're beginning to think that the Homo habilis evolved alongside the Homo erectus for about the same amount of time. We do know that about 2 million years ago, there was this really archaic human being called the Homo ergaster, who lived in Africa. She would have been fairly sophisticated enough to use stone tools, and she would have taught these methods to her children. At some point around 1.8 million years ago, her and her people, the Homo ergaster, split into many different bands like we talked about. So one of the bands would have ended up coming out of Africa and going a little bit north into the Middle East. Some would go a little bit more east and head into Asia, and some would travel all the way up to Europe. Their culture and communities lasted for hundreds of thousands of years. And the culture and the communities and the people would spread down into China and into Java. Many of us grew up hearing that Homo sapiens poured out of Africa into Europe and Asia starting about 80,000 years ago. What we are beginning to realize is that Homo erectus had been taking those same routes out of Africa for over a million years. In fact, we know that when Homo sapiens left Africa, they would have encountered other humans who looked very much like themselves, maybe a different branch of the Homo ergaster. They would have all been descendants of a common ancestor, that we now know we share with Neanderthals, as well as descendants of Homo erectus. All of these people were early humans, and they all came from this common ancestor who started in Africa and branched out, and then due to different factors, changed and changed and changed. The name Homo erectus usually umbrellas over several different subspecies, including Homo gregoricus, which had a more humanoid pelvis and spine, which allowed it to cover longer distances and follow prey. And the pelvis-spine combination was necessary for humans to be able to do persistence hunting. Now, persistence hunting is a little terrifying, and I want to tell you about it because it's still actually used in some tribes today. Anthropologists have documented it. It's a hunting technique where hunters use a combination of running and walking, and they pursue their prey until their prey is exhausted. Now, one of the evolutionary advantages that humans have over other animals is the ability to sweat, right? So we sweat, that allows us to reduce our body heat, while other quadrupedal prey have to slow down in order to pant. So you will see, you know, leopards in the desert hiding under the shade for hours and hours at a time, resting because they don't have the kind of energy and they need to pant and slow down. So early humans used this to their advantage. They could outlast their prey. So even if their tools weren't as developed as, say, modern weapons or even ancient weapons that we know about, like spears and things like that, we know that they used this form of outlasting their prey. Like I said, there are a few groups like the Kalahari Bushmen and the Tarahumara Rarámuri people of northern Mexico that still do this. It requires an incredible amount of endurance. You have to be able to run long distances for a long extended period of time. And it should be noted that in all the primates, endurance running is only seen in humans. Persistence hunting is thought to be one of the earliest forms of human hunting. So they gather around and they chase an animal for hours and hours and hours. For example, if they were hunting an antelope, they would outrun it until it got run down in the midday heat. Depending on the different environmental conditions would depend on the outcome. Now, researchers that have watched the Kalahari watch them chase a kudu, which is like an antelope, for about 2 to 5 hours. The hunter chases the kudu, which then runs away out of sight. By tracking it down at a fast running pace, the hunter can catch up with it before it has enough time to rest in the shade. And the animal is repeatedly chased and tracked down until it is too exhausted to continue running. The hunter then goes up at a close range and kills it with a spear. That is one of the ways that early Homo sapiens survived. Compared with modern Homo sapiens, us, which have only been around for the last 200,000 years, Homo erectus, or the upright man, had a long time that they were on the earth. The ancient ancestor of modern humans lived from 2 million years ago to about 100,000 years ago, to even possibly 50,000 years ago. Homo erectus developed out of one of these bands, and they were much taller. They were about 6 feet tall. Now, I want you to think about this for your next sci-fi movie script. All right. Right now, when we read about sci-fi, a terrifying thing is like a zombie, you know, a slow-moving walking dead that can bite you with its poisonous bite. Or maybe tiny, slimy green aliens that have cute little heads and big eyes. But if you think about it, human beings, Homo sapiens, are terrifying. Why aren't they the villain? I stumbled across this great thing on Tumblr from a user called Bogleech. This is what this person says, quote, "It's funny how science fiction universe so often treats human beings as a boring default everyman species or even the weakest and dumbest. I want to see a sci-fi universe when we're actually considered one of the most hideous and terrifying species. How do we know our saliva and skin oils wouldn't be ultra-corrosive to most other sapient races? What if we actually have the strongest vocal cords and can paralyze or kill the inhabitants of other worlds just by screaming at them? What if the most sentient life in the universe turns out to be vegetable-like and lives in fear of us rare animal races who can move so quickly and chew things up with our teeth? Like that old story, they're made of meat, only we're scarier. More seriously, humans do have a number of advantages even among terrestrial life. Our endurance shock, resistance, and ability to recover from injury is absurdly high compared to almost any other animal. We often use phrases like healthy as a horse to connote hardiness, but compared to a human, a horse is as fragile as spun glass. There's mounting evidence that our primitive ancestors would hunt large prey simply by following it at a walking pace, without sleep or rest, until it died of exhaustion. It's called pursuit predation. Basically, we're the Terminator. The only other animal that can keep up with us are dogs. That's why we use them for hunting, and even then, it's only sort of. Now extrapolate that to a galaxy in which most sapient life did not evolve from hyper-specialized pursuit predators. Our strength and speed is nothing to write home about. But we don't need to overpower or outrun you. We just need to outlast you. And by any other species standards, we just plain don't get tired. Where a simple broken leg will cause most species to go into shock and die, we can recover from virtually any injury that's not immediately fatal. Even traumatic disembowelment isn't necessarily a career-ending injury for humans. We heal from injuries with extreme rapidity, recovering in weeks from wounds that would take others months or years to heal. The results aren't pretty. Humans have hyperactive scar tissue among any other survival-oriented traits, but they're highly functional. Speaking of scarring, look at our medical science. We've developed surgery centuries before developing even the most rudimentary anesthetics or life support in extremis. Humans have known to perform surgery on themselves and survive. Thanks to our extreme hardiness, we regard as routine medical procedures what other species would regard as inventive forms of murder. We even perform radical surgery on ourselves for purely cosmetic reasons. Our jaws have too many teeth in them, so we developed a way to weld metal to our teeth and force the bones in our jaw to restructure over the course of years to fit them back into shape. And then we continue to wear metal in our mouths to keep them in place. We formed cohabitative relationships with tiny mammals and insects. We keep at bay from bothering us by death, often using little analog traps. And by God, we will eat anything. We use borderline toxic peppers to season our food. We expose ourselves to potentially lethal solar radiation in the pursuit of darkening our skin. We risk hearing loss for the opportunity to see our favorite musicians live. We have a game where two people get in an enclosed area and hit each other until time runs out or one of them passes out. We willingly jump out of airplanes with only a flimsy piece of cloth to prevent us from splattering against the ground. Our response to natural disasters is just to rebuild our buildings in the exact same places. We climb mountains and risk freezing to death for bragging rights. We basically invented dogs. We took our one-time predators and completely domesticated them. On a planet full of lions, tigers, and bears, we managed to advance further and faster than any other species on the planet. It's one thing to face down a cheetah, which will slam into you at 60 miles per hour and break your neck. It's another thing to run very quickly to get away from a thing, only to have it just kind of show up. To have it to be intelligent enough to figure out where you are by the fur and feather you've left behind, your footprints, and then you think you've lost it and you bed down on the night, but there it is, waiting when you wake up. And you split, but it keeps following you, always in the corner of your eye, until you just die. We are scary mother effers. Isn't that great? I mean, when you think about it that way, human beings are terrifying. We have a lot going for us. Now, culture is an interesting thing that we're going to cover immensely in this in this podcast. Culture is fascinating to me, and cultural anthropology is of huge interest to me and is what got me interested in the subject altogether. There was a species found in Heidelberg, Germany in 1907, Homo pekinensis and the Homo heidelbergensis, which had a brain size similar to Homo sapiens. And the discovery of 28 Homo heidelbergensis skeletons suggests that this might have been the first species that we know of that would bury its dead. This is really important to think about. Why burying dead is important. What other animals do we know of that bury their dead? We're not the only ones. If you'll believe it, there are some species of chimpanzees and magpies that throw grass and branches over their dead. Elephants are said to also throw leaves over their dead. But this shows us the beginnings of culture, that a band of humans got together and death meant something to them. It meant something to them that they just didn't leave their fallen on the ground and keep running, that they took time, and time was critical. Back in these early ancient times, time needed to be used for survival and getting food and traveling away from predators. All of that time and energy was critical. Humans needed every single calorie they could take for those tasks, and yet we see them start to use it to bury their dead. In this episode, I have an anthropologist who's going to talk about bipedalism, and that's important too because that talks about how when human beings become bipedal, it causes a lot of our hair to be lost on the body and allows us to sweat better and to keep animals cool like we talked about before. The combination of abundant sweat glands and a hairless body and dark skin allowed our species to hunt and forage in the sun for a lot longer than any other animals. Now, Homo erectus was one of the first species to make use of fire. Fire was a critical invention, and now we talk about it a lot, that it was an ancient invention. Any sort of images you see of cavemen show fire. But fire allowed early humans to cook food for the first time. This is important because it might take a chimpanzee hours and hours and hours to chew up raw fruit. But fire softens it. It improves the protein from meats and allows for this easier digestion of really complex carbohydrates from the plants. Easier digestion is important because that means that we can extract more calories from the food per unit, and therefore we get more energy. So easier digestion of food allowed for shorter digestive tracts in humans, which is where we start to see smaller teeth and jaws and larger brains. In addition to expanding what could be eaten, fire also allowed for activity at night and protection against predators and insects that had an aversion to flame. Some anthropologists believe that fire came much later and an increase in brain size was due to a diet shift from forage plants to hunted or uncooked meat. But we do know that fire helped early humans survive. If humans only ate raw, unprocessed food, humans would need to eat 9.3 hours a day in order to fuel their brains. So you'd have to be eating all day long and use about twice as much resting energy by percentage as other primates. So these different groups of Homo ergasters were moving out of Africa. Some move into Europe and they would create homes in what are now Italy, Spain, France, Germany, and England. And this group up there evolved a thicker brow and a more barrel-chested body. These are the early humans popularly called Neanderthals or Neanderthals. Now, for a long time, it was believed that they were a separate species that died out that weren't related to humans. And now we're starting to know differently that there is a common ancestor. But back down in Africa, other groups of the Homo ergasters are branching out. One that stayed in Africa was building colonies all over the coast of the continent, reaching from South Africa all the way up to Algeria and Morocco. And about 200,000 years ago, their skeletal shape had become indistinguishable from modern humans. This is where Homo sapiens emerged. In January 1987, Rebecca Kahn took a research team along with Mark Stone King and Alan Wilson and discovered something that dropped a bombshell on our understanding of modern human evolution. Kahn laid out the experimental groundwork for the concept of what we call mitochondrial Eve, and out of that comes the consequent out-of-Africa theory. From the late 1970s, she had collected mitochondrial DNA samples from women of different ethnic backgrounds, such as Asia, South Pacific, Europe, and Americans of African descent. The data she used in her PhD thesis in 1982 and following her research, a junior graduate student, Mark Stone King, added samples from Aboriginal Australians and New Guineans. In 1987, after a year of delay, they published this paper in Nature Journal, in which their findings indicate that all living human beings were descended through a single mother who lived 200,000 years ago. The theoretical mother of all human popularly became known as mitochondrial Eve, and the underlying concept directly implies recent African origin of modern humans. And this is where we get the out-of-Africa theory that we talked about earlier. Until then, the prevailing theory held that many different groups of humans evolved separately in different regions. So we had the Neanderthals up in the north, and we had Homo sapiens in a different area. But Rebecca Kahn's work revealed that all humans carried mitochondrial DNA in their cells and dated back to a single woman. At first, this research met with tremendous controversy. It was sort of the death knell of multi-regional hypotheses, and it was hard for a lot of people to give up. But even though we have a single ancestor we can trace everything back to, you need to remember that evolution rarely follows a straight line from species to species. Like I said earlier, it's more like a tree with many branches. And some branches lead to new branches, while other branches become dead ends, like the Neanderthals. They would have been killed out. We have a common ancestor because whoever she is, she's the creator whose children split into two groups who eventually evolved into modern apes and modern humans. There is ample persuasive evidence of human evolution taking place in Africa instead of Asia. So there's absolutely no question that Homo sapiens had origins in culture and communities that are dramatically different from our own. So different that they would have belonged to different species. There are a lot of people that want to discover a pure lineage that springs from the line of Homo sapiens who left Africa relatively recently in human history. It's really hard to determine, and the answer is really a matter of interpretation. American journalist and IO9 writer Annalie Newitt sums it up here. Quote, "A few years ago, anthropologist John Rutherford summed up the complicated debate over what happened next by offering a somewhat simplified way to understand three dominant theories. The African replacement theory, sometimes called the recent African origins theory, holds that Homo sapiens charged out of Africa and crushed Homo neanderthalensis and Homo erectus under their feet. Basically, Homo sapiens replaced her distant cousins. This theory is simple, and the mitochondrial Eve discoveries of biochemist Rebecca Kahn and colleagues support it with genetic evidence that shows all humans on Earth can trace their genetic ancestry to Homo sapien woman from Africa. But if you step back for a second and look at this theory from a historical perspective, it starts to seem more unlikely. First of all, it assumes that Homo sapiens treated her cousins as enemies. Or, as some anthropologists seem to suggest, she saw them as animals rather than members of her own family. The question is, how likely is it that a group of tired Homo sapien wanderers coming upon an opportunity of Homo erectus with tools and recognizably human faces would attack them or ignore them as animals? Most likely they would trade with the locals and possibly spend a while hanging out with them while they rested on their long journey. And that's the kind of thinking that got the multi-regional theory started. Popularized by anthropologist Milford Woolpoff, this theory fits with the same evidence that supports the African replacement theory. It's just a very different interpretation of the evidence. Woolpoff suggested that Homo sapiens didn't sweep Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis away, but instead never really lost track of them in the first place. Woolpoff's idea hinges on the very sensible notion that Homo ergaster didn't leave Africa, but instead forged a pathway that many other archaic humans followed in both directions. Just as humans had trade routes that linked far-flung lands in recorded history, our earliest ancestors probably had something similar. There's plenty of evidence that humans left many outposts along the route from Africa to Asia and Europe. Who is to say that Homo sapiens wasn't always intermingling and interbreeding with Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis? If Woolpoff and his colleagues are right, and evolutionary biologist John Hawkins has presented compelling genetic evidence for this, then Homo sapiens probably don't arise in Africa and colonize the rest of the world. Instead, she rose at roughly the same time throughout the world through this extended network. The multi-regional theory does not suggest that two or three separate human lineages evolved in parallel, by the way. That's a common misinterpretation. It just suggests that there weren't two distinct waves of immigration like we originally thought, some going north and some going east. Instead, immigration and the evolution of Homo sapiens started around 1.8 million years ago and just never stopped. There's a kind of middle of the road theory too, which many dub the assimilation theory. Vinayak Iswaran and colleagues outline a theory like this in a recent paper where they argue that genetic evidence suggests that there were two distinct waves of immigration out of Africa, the archaic human one and the Homo sapiens one. But as Homo sapiens move out of the world, she assimilated with the local Homo erectus and the Homo Neanderthals people. So basically, in the assimilation theory model, Homo sapiens didn't destroy her kindred, nor was she deeply interrelated with them, as in the multi-regional theory. She met them as strangers, but forged alliances and formed families with them. Gradually, though, Homo sapiens became the dominant culture. Now, that might seem complicated, so I'm going to let American anthropologist Chelsea Shields explain this in her own words.
My name is Chelsea Shields. I'm a biological anthropology professor, human evolution. My research is on the evolution and elicitation of placebo effects in indigenous healing and medicine and ritual. So a lot of my work has to do with the relationship between social interactions and physiological processes. But in order to understand that, I have to understand how our bodies evolved and why. And so I'm going to just ramp you up and then get into things in more detail.
That sounds good. Let's get started.
Okay. So just to give you a really brief, we split between about 6 to 7 million years ago between our last common ancestor with chimpanzees and humans. And so we're going to start there, and I'm not going to walk you through every single different, species, but I'm just going to kind of, talk about the basic timeline. So what we see is, you know, a lot of pre-Australopithecines. That's where you get like an Ardipithecus ramidus. Then we begin to see Australopithecines that share a lot of similar traits. And then we get, you know, there's a whole branch of that through the fossil record. So we see kind of a phylogenetic break. And then we get early hominids, early Homo. So what we're going to talk about today is everything ranging from Homo habilis all the way up to Homo sapiens, and then get into some of these developmental processes that are related to females particularly. So, you know, one of the differences between Australopithecines and Homo is actually a much more gracile skull. So we see a more rounded skull. We see a greater frontal lobe. We see less protruding brow ridges, which is really important because a lot of the frontal lobe capacity, executive decision-making, impulse control, a lot of that takes place right near your forehead. And so we really begin to see intelligence factors taking place, not only just in brain growth, but in the frontal lobe development. So that's an important thing. Homo habilis was really famous because what we find with the fossil record there is the development of more complex tools. So it's really where Homo habilis used to be called the tool man, right? And this is where we begin some of the feminist critiques of hominid evolution, is that with Homo habilis, right, the most relatable, the closest to us, Australopithecines still appear a lot closer to apes, Homo begins to look a lot more like humans. These are some of the illustrations or drawings that you'll see that are bipedal and use tools and are social. And so a lot of early theorists related to Homo habilis as this is the first instances where we begin to see the human in Homo, right? And one of the reasons for that is it was the tools. And so he was called Man the Hunter. And this is the paradigm that existed in the mid-1900s, where the crux of human evolution began with this man that made tools and went out and hunted. And some reasons for the critique of this that I think are important here, a couple of things, which are, you know, a lot of tools that were used near the hearth and around the hearth were actually tools used, you know, to prepare foods, to prepare meats. And that was actually female driven, type of activity. So absolutely tools were used to hunt and kill. But a lot of tools were used to prepare, and those tools are actually a little bit more complicated. And so just assuming like man the hunter is kind of the development of why we made tools to begin with is, again, a little bit, you know, sexist in its leaning. We also see that a lot of the food sources being brought in, if we do studies for hunter-gatherer societies, there's a great article about the Hadza where they really compare a lot of hunter-gatherer societies to kind of weigh how much meat is being brought in versus just gathering nuts and berries. And we see that the bulk of the diet of what would be hunting-gathering societies, which we argue are the types of divisions of labors that were occurring in this time period, are actually by women. So meat did have an enormous adjustment on our gastrointestinal development, and I'll talk about that in a second, but so much of what hominids were actually eating was brought in, at least from hunter-gatherer studies, from the women. And so it's one of those arguments of tools being, you know, made, of course, for men, by men, and for male purposes that need to kind of be adjusted in modern thinking. So as we talk about that, we want to begin to talk about why meat eating is important. And we do see an enormous distribution of a variety of animals around Homo habilis sites and fossil records. And so that's important because you can go to a hearth, you can see and distinguish all the bones there. And for example, in one Homo habilis, you know, site at Olduvai, we see elephant bones, giraffe bones, hippopotamus, rhinoceros, primate bones, carnivore, other carnivores, equids, suids, and bovids. So we see all of that just from one hearth. So we are seeing a drastic increase in meat eating. And that's an important, you know, thing to begin to see. And one of the reasons why that affects us so much in the big picture is I want you to kind of think of this concept called the meat to gut hypothesis. And what that is plants take so much more digestive energy to actually process. So animals that are herbivores have very large guts. So, for example, like a gorilla, they have enormous stomach power to consume and process plant and get nutrients, extract the nutrients from plant food sources. We just kind of think of it as like a balance, right? As the plant eating goes down, the stomach size, or we call it the gut, also goes down. There's less energetic need for the ability to process food because meat, insects, fruit, all of those things are much easier to digest and process and get nutrients from. And so we can kind of see that when we have an omnivore, we see a much more moderate stomach, right? Gut size. And if you see something that's largely a carnivore, you actually see a much reduced stomach size. And that's because you get high caloric intake, a lot of nutrients, not a lot of processing power. So one of the arguments is about the meat to gut hypothesis is that as humans ate a lot more meat, we had all this extra energy that we didn't need to process. And a lot of that went to brain growth. So this is another one of those arguments that, you know, the meat to gut hypothesis is a great hypothesis. It's well known. It's highly respected. But the argument again is focused on hunting and meat eating being the source of our brain and our development. And so it becomes a lot male-centric again of man the hunter, man the meat gatherer, and his ability to bring home meat allowed us to have large brains. And so we again have to look at a lot of, let's say something like chimpanzee cultures, right, that are omnivorous, which we would, you know, and that also hunt and that also bring home meat. And we see that a bulk of their diet is not necessarily a daily hunting and bringing home large bovids, let's say. A lot of their meat is actually termite hunting, right? It's getting insects. It's getting things that give us that high caloric intake. And the meat is actually kind of a surprise. It's something that is not a daily staple. So, again, we're putting so much weight on kind of bringing in meat and hunting as the catalyst of evolution and brain growth when arguably we don't see the numbers to back that up. And so for years, this is kind of why we see in evolutionary studies this long-term man-the-hunter, male-focused, male-centric argument for human development and brain growth that we think needs to change. And it is. So, so that's one aspect as we get out of Homo habilis, mainly because his whole name is based on on hunting and tools. So if we're just to do something kind of quick to walk you through kind of the basic things we're going to talk about till we get to humans is Homo habilis to Homo erectus to, you know, archaic Homo sapiens to Homo sapiens. And there's other side trees in that, right? We're going to talk about Homo ergaster versus Homo erectus, and that's just based on locality, Homo heidelbergensis, and then we're going to have to talk about Neanderthals, right? So we'll walk through that right now and go through those pretty quickly so we can get into some more exciting stuff. So Homo erectus is really famous. It's something that almost everyone knows. And one of the reasons for that is we begin to see the widespread distribution of populations with Homo erectus. We see them coming out of Africa. We see them basically taking over the world. So it's a very mobile migratory species. And this is really where we begin to see the ecology and the climate shift for our ancestors outside of really tropic areas. So the difference between Homo erectus and Homo ergaster is that Homo ergaster is the African form. It's the form that basically stayed in Africa. And Homo erectus is what we call the forms that expanded outside of. We see a lot of Homo erectus in the fossil record, in Asia, for example. So that's really what distinguishes those two. But we can just refer to it right now as Homo erectus because we're most interested in the out of Africa types of species we're beginning to see in the culture that's developing. So we see Homo erectus show up about 1.8 million years ago. And really, it's not that different from prior hominids. It is a little bit bigger, has a bigger brain. The real key factor is that we're finding it outside of Africa. And we do begin to see even a little bit slighter advanced tools, right, from Homo habilis. But, you know, we see, you know, some modern human traits that are approximate of modern human traits. And the biggest differences we see from Homo habilis to Homo erectus is we see increased brain size, increased body size, and the cranial shape changing. And that's important. As we see cranial shape changing, this is what I was talking about when we see the lessening of the occipital lobe, which is in the back, and the increase of the vertical forehead or the frontal lobe. And that's really important to see that cranial shape because we're seeing different executive functionings happening. And really, we're not saying, you know, I'm sure you guys have had a primer in these podcasts that we're not saying, you know, the frontal lobe is, you know, has more executive functioning. Therefore, every, you know, Homo erectus began to develop the frontal lobe. No, the way this works is that people with greater frontal lobe capacity and executive decision making or impulse control, you know, survived and reproduced at higher rates in the population. And therefore, those traits would increase in frequency. And over time, we'd begin to see those traits stabilize at a high frequency. So that's what we're talking about when I say things like that. Another change we're seeing that's important is a change in dentition. And I talked about earlier about morphology of the mouth and the chin and the palate and the tongue, which allowed for speech. And we don't get speech yet. Homo erectus is not speaking. But what we're seeing is a shift in the dentition that would allow for more space for tongue to move upwards and downwards. And we're seeing a slow shift, which we won't see till Homo sapiens, toward a chin, which allows the space right under your tongue down here to have more flexibility and allows us to actually pronunciate and say certain types of vowels and consonants. So again, the argument is not that Homo erectus could speak or had, you know, executive frontal lobe capacity, but we're beginning to see those cranial and dentition shifts that are going to be really important to modern Homo sapiens. So that's kind of what we're seeing there with Homo erectus. Again, we see a lot of tools, more advanced tools. When we get into Homo erectus at like Zucidian or something in China, are really fascinating cases of larger social groups. And that's going to be really important as we move toward discussing, you know, gender and discussing Homo sapiens and culture is the increase of social group size. And that's when we're beginning to see this is with Homo erectus. And what that means is, or why that's important is that with greater group size, there's greater social complexity and you need to remember people and remember reputations and cooperate and figure out reciprocity and mutual aid. And all of those complexities have to take place with larger group size. And we'll see in a little bit of of how that led to increased brain size. So again, the things to remember about Homo erectus are, you know, first widespread species, colonizing seasonal habitats, you know, the larger brain suggests longer periods of maturation and infant dependency. It's still nowhere near modern humans, but we begin to see, like I said, those life histories expanding with greater infant dependency and juvenility. There are some very small but still interesting arguments that we see fire with Homo erectus at places like Sukidian. So in China. So, you know, there's some interesting cultural adaptations that are happening alongside these physical ones. And one would argue that these cultural adaptations need to take place in certain types of climates where our bodies are not as naturally adapted to. And so we would see different types of cultural shifts taking place to allow us to colonize those habitats. So again, we see more complex tools and we see, you know, more complexity of culture as we see the group size shifts. So, and Homo erectus is found in the fossil record from 1.8 million years ago, like I said, to 200,000 years ago. And so that's really interesting, of how long they were successful and existed. And when you know that, you know, we argue that modern Homo sapiens started developing around 150,000 years ago, we're getting really, really, really close to our own development. So that's an exciting and interesting thing to note. Probably the next one in the line is Homo heidelbergensis. And the reason why, you know, this is the name is that it found in Germany, actually. So we begin to see some European species. And one of the things that separates, you know, Homo heidelbergensis from something like ergaster or erectus is we see a rapid increase in cranial capacity again, right? We see much more encephalized brain, something that even overlaps with modern humans. But we still do see this occipital lobe. So if a lot of the cranial capacity is in the back, we don't anticipate the types of intelligence that we're seeing in modern Homo sapiens. So we still see large brow ridges, but we see kind of a thinner, you know, skull and a little bit taller. So we're getting that vertical shift that we need, even though the occipital bun isn't decreasing. So that just means we're getting much larger brains all over the place. And we're seeing less prognathism, which is, like I said, that protruding of the face. And that's important as well. And the thinner cranial bones than we've ever seen before in all of the hominid lineage. And the reason why that's important is because it's about brain growth and continued brain growth. So with really, really thick cranial bones, we don't see at a certain critical time period, the brain doesn't continue growing over the course of a long period of time. So the thinner bones kind of suggest a much larger and longer growing brain growth. So that's important. At the same time that I say this is, you know, Homo heidelbergensis was found in Germany, that's what the name is, we see the same types of shared features across Asia and Europe and even in Africa. So that thinning of the bones, the vertical lift, the increased cranial capacity, all of those things, more of a more graciality coming into play. A lot of that is dating around that time period post Homo erectus, and we're seeing it across the planet. So that's important to note, that it wasn't just happening in Europe. We see more advanced tools like we've seen in previous types of transitions, big game hunting, different food sources, etc. So from here, we're going to get into a discussion on Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. And then as soon as we're done with that, we'll really get into some of the stuff that deals more with humans' development and gender. So one of the things to note with Neanderthals is that, you know, the distribution was largely in, you know, Europe and Central Asia. We really don't see as large of a shift in Neanderthals. It didn't go as far. And their timeline ranges from about 130,000 years ago to about 30,000 years ago. And so that puts them very, very close to Homo sapiens and would have occupied similar spaces as Homo sapiens. And that's why Neanderthals are, you know, talked about so much, and the relationship between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals is such a fascination between people, because it is something that we would have seen a lot of crossover. What differentiates Neanderthals from Heidelbergensis is, you know, much more rounded, thinner cranium. Again, these things are just things that increase on a continuum. But we still see a low forehead, very large cranial capacity. This is actually larger than most modern humans, the cranial capacity of Neanderthals. And so that's another one of those times where I'm like, cranial capacity in terms of just largeness is less important than how and where it develops. And so Neanderthals had these enormous brains, but they still had low foreheads and large occipitable, not as large as previous generations, but much larger than humans. And then they also had very large brow ridges, right? And some prognathism that is completely lost in Homo sapiens. So, and we also do not see a chin. And that's important because when the chin actually is produced, we get the space that we need to see language. And so the argument between Neanderthals that is often cited is, you know, did Neanderthals speak? And it's gone back and forth and back and forth. And the last estimation is that they have, the argument when we were able to look at some of the genetics of Neanderthals is that they have the genetic capacity to speak the FOXP2, gene, which is really important in the ability to process, language. And we also see some morphological changes that would have allowed speech. And so the latest argument as of 2015 is that we probably did see speech happening with Neanderthals. And we also in the genetics found that we probably also are seeing a lot of inbreeding between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. So that's the two arguments that people have wondered for a long time that have been kind of cleared up with modern paleoanthropology. So some of the behavioral shifts in Neanderthals is really important is that it's the first time we begin to see things like burials. And the reason why a burial is so important is that it was, you know, had to be ritual practices on purpose. So if you see a burial and people are positioned in a certain way with certain artifacts placed in a certain way, it might indicate evidence of symbolism. It might indicate evidence of a belief in the afterlife, of care for someone for a purpose. And that's really interesting. This would kind of, I would argue, be early remnants of the beginnings of what I argue is irrationality. And that's one of the things that separates humans from all other species is our ability to be not only irrational, but be irrational with each other. So an entire group of people can think of, you know, abstract thoughts like the afterlife and religion and symbolism and all agree on these very, you know, non-instrumental or referential types of thinking. So there is some evidence that we see that with Neanderthals, and that's an interesting thing to argue. Again, we see much more complex tools. We do see, you know, common ancestor and a divergence about 400,000 years ago between modern Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. And, you know, we'll talk here about some of the differences. And I talked about that a little bit that we see, you know, with humans, what we're beginning to see in cranial morphology is a very high vertical forehead. And that's really important. Like we've said, a lessening of the occipital bone, low brow ridges. We see, you know, all that prognathism, that kind of snout being reduced, much flatter face. And we see the protrusion of a chin in modern Homo sapiens. And that's really, really important for speech. So some other things we see is, you know, less robust bones, much thinner cranial bones. You know, we begin to see a lot more increased tool usage, a lot more climates occupied. We begin to see much larger social groups. We see much more complex shelter. We begin to see the evidence of higher population densities, longer lives. We see lots of things that we haven't seen in previous types of hominids, which is serious injuries or diseases that people survived and continued to live. So you see evidence of those in the bones that we don't really see with other species. And what that means is, and this isn't always the case. Of course, you can have an animal that suffered some, like a very serious bone break that then survives, and we can see evidence of this. But the degree of the injury and the amount of the evidence in the fossil record suggests that there were people who were sick, old, and injured that were taken care of by others. So this is another reason to kind of argue for the social hypothesis, which is, you know, that people began to take care of each other as the social groups increased, so that each person did not have to produce their own, you know, food source or die off. So that's something interesting that we see. So we also begin to see a lot of tools made from things that aren't local, which means that there's a lot of trading and bartering between groups happening, or lots of traveling happening. And we absolutely see evidence of ritual burials by the time of early Homo sapiens. So that's, you know, the remains of certain types of symbolic jewelry and placement of certain types of flowers and clothing. So there's really good evidence as we get into Homo sapiens. Some of the artwork and the shelters of these groups is just fascinating. I love showing some of the cave art. I love showing some of the early, you know, structures. The complexity is just incredibly gorgeous. So, I love getting into that type of stuff. So I think the next thing I want to talk about is, let's talk a little bit more about modern humans, and then I want to get into the stuff that I find the most fascinating, what keeps me up at night and gets me really excited. I'll try to go over this briefly to keep you all interested. So I've talked a lot about human life history. And what I want you to imagine is kind of these different stages of the human life cycle. So prenatal, infancy, juvenility, kind of being an adolescent, going into reproductive adult years, and post-reproductive adult years. And what we see with humans compared to, you know, other prosimians, monkeys and apes and other species, is that each of those stages is expanded, right? So compared to other primates, we're unique in a lot of these areas, especially something called the post-reproductive life. And that has a lot to do with gender. And so there's been a lot of arguments of, well, why would humans live after their inability to reproduce? And this is what we call the grandmother hypothesis. The argument here is that because human infants are so dependent, it would be their chances of surviving and thriving drastically reduce if you are, you know, very, very old and unable to provide food and shelter and protection and all the things that a baby needs, as well as the physiological ability to carry, birth, feed, and sustain a child. And so one of the arguments here is that women who were, you know, unable to give birth after a certain age, were able to invest a lot of that energy into taking care of their grandchildren or their children to help provide food that they needed, rather than reproducing themselves. And they actually had more kin that survived and reproduced. And this led to greater frequencies of what we call like a post-reproductive life, or what we say post-menopause. So we don't see this idea of menopause in any other species. And we don't necessarily see it with males, right? And so it's something that's highly equivalent and related to child rearing, child raising, the health of you know, a fetus and their development and care. And so that's a fascinating example of looking at the evolutionary landscape from a gendered perspective of, why would this exist only in women and not men? Why would this be useful, and why would we see this survive over time? And a lot of that has to do with, you know, keeping the highest quality care. The argument that the highest quality care would produce individuals who survived and reproduced at higher rates. And so grandmothers would contribute to that more than if they had their own young. So that's an interesting thing that makes us unique in that period. Another interesting gender argument that I think is pretty fascinating is, we often talk about birth and motherhood and pregnancy and rearing in quite a positive, loving nature, because it wouldn't make sense that if you hated your child, you know, those children probably wouldn't reproduce and survive at high rates, and those, you know, we wouldn't see those frequency of those traits existing for much longer, right? Because if you're such a dependent infant, we wouldn't see this happening. At the same time, there's a conflict that happens in women's bodies that isn't talked about quite enough. And there's a couple of great books on this in evolutionary theory. but I really want to talk about that conflict a little bit. So there's a big balance between that women make often between their own interests and the interests of their young. And the first stage of that actually is in what we call female choice and dating. And so, so often in our modern society, we see women who, you know, care about their clothes and makeup, and we think, oh, women are the ones who, you know, have to attract men. But throughout all, basically, or most, I should say, of evolutionary history, it's actually the men who are on display trying to attract women. So think of birds of paradise. Think of the bullfrogs, you know, sounds. Think of elk antlers. Think of moose. Think of elephant seals. Often it's, or peacocks. Peacocks are the perfect example. Often it's the male of the species that exhibit the most elaborate traits to attract women. And one of the reasons for that is different reproductive strategies. So if you're a male and you have a total fertility rate that can expand the course of your lifetime, and there's no limit to the amount of sperm you can make, right, then they're really the only limiting factor on how many offspring you have is, you know, how many women you can have sex with. So the limiting factor on male reproductive strategies is pretty low. It's just if you can mate. With women, it's quite different. You only have a certain range of time in which you can have children, okay? And over the course of that lifetime, if women and men both had as many children as humanly possible, by the end of a woman's lifetime, just theoretically, she might have, at a maximum, if you did the perfect calculations and got pregnant every time and didn't lose any children, you know, somewhere, you know, between 50 to 75 children, right? Depends on how long she lives, how long she, you know, can avoid menopause, and how early she begins. But a man, think about Genghis Khan, could have tens of thousands, if not more, offspring. And so the total fertility rate between men and women is astronomically different. And that's partially why we have such different sexual reproductive strategies. And so the old adage of, like, you know, men just try to spread their seeds and women try to, you know, quantity over quality is actually quite accurate. And I say that with a caution and a caveat, because in, there's a lot of feminist critiques of the way we talk about evolutionary theory and reproductive strategy, because one of the arguments is that by saying men's, evolved intuition or instinct is to spread their seed, validates or justifies a lot of male violence, sexual violence against women, and the types of forced copulations and rape we see throughout history and throughout, especially human history, and other primates. So is it justifying rape to say that this is a strategy that males use in reproducing? And so it's a big, hotspot for feminist evolutionary anthropology. And one of the greatest, professors I had that kind of sum that up is, you know, we're not talking about what should happen or what ought to happen or what, you know, an excuse given to a man today in modern society. We're talking about what has happened, what is happening, you know, throughout our evolutionary story, which is that a lot of copulations were forced. Now, that doesn't make it right, doesn't make it good. It just is. And we have to look at that as this is a strategy that, you know, our ancestors or males use to increase their total fertility rate. You know, not that that is a good thing. And so I it's a hard, you know, battle and line to walk that I want to make sure, you know, I debate the concept of different gendered reproductive strategies. And I think that they're, you know, it doesn't necessarily play out in something like modern dating as if, as some people like to make it. But I do think it's important to note the strictures and limitations on the different reproductive strategies that make them what they are. And so, for example, however, I definitely need to say this caveat. However, we've put too much emphasis on male reproductive strategy. We often will talk about men, boys will be boys, they need to spread their seeds, men are not made to be monogamous, etc. And really, if you think about it, it's women throughout history who have had the power to shift the evolutionary balance. The seed will not be spread if women don't want to mate. Now, that's not always the case. Again, we get back to forced copulations. We get into, I could talk about, you know, alpha male, beta male, reproductive strategies. But as we jump into more modern societies where something like forced copulation or rape would be, you know, would have repercussions, then women's power increases. Something as simple as hidden ovulation, the fact that women are, you know, humans are some of the only female species that have ovulation that's hidden, is one of those strategies that we have that means that, you know, we're not flashing a signal every time we're ovulating to the point where, you know, that's when men would typically try to mate in order to increase their total fertility. And so that's a strategy or an adaptation that has happened over time that actually empowers the female of the species to kind of hide when she's reproductively available and viable, that gives, you know, women sort of power over her sexuality. And I know I'm saying this in much modern terms that a lot of scientists will be like, oh my gosh, but I'm trying to just kind of explain some of these basic concepts. So that hidden ovulation is a really good way for women to kind of, men never know when she's ovulating, and neither do women necessarily. And so it allows them to have power throughout her entire cycle if we argue that women are the limiting factor in reproduction. So that's an interesting way to look at this evolutionary relationship, is that women do have actually more of the limiting powers. So, and what I mean by that is that women are born with a certain amount of eggs. So I love to explain the concept of fetuses are born with the amount of eggs that they will ever have. And we see this fight, this battle take place actually in the womb. So in cases of war, in cases of high stress, we see enormous population shifts where after something like September 11th, for example, we see an enormous bump in the births of men versus females. Usually it stays pretty even male to female ratios. That old mental model of man the hunter, and people argued, well, oh, in cases of war or stress, males are born because males can fight and we're raising a new generation of warriors. What we actually find is quite different. We find that males are actually just easier to make. So because men can, you know, have as many sperm, you know, have an unlimited amount of sperm, and those sperm begin to develop during puberty. And after, you know, let's say we've lost all our sperm, you can regenerate in a couple hours. That's not the case with women. With women, the development of a female fetus is much more costly and much more careful than the development of a male fetus. And so we see, there's a great study on, you know, spontaneous abortions, and the ratio of female spontaneous abortions is much higher than the ratio of males. Basically, that just means men can kind of, you know, get across the final approval line, to be developed and born and receive a lot of the energetic costs of gestation, much further than a female fetus. So if a female fetus isn't communicating health metrics or signaling to the mother in the womb that it is a, you know, viable offspring, that it's developing healthily, it will more often be, spontaneously aborted than a male fetus. And what this leads to is a couple of interesting things. So one of the arguments in gender is, for example, you know, men are smarter than women. Let's look at case studies. Let's look at tests. Let's look at geniuses. Let's look at, Nobel Peace Prize winners or something like that. And, you know, we can argue all the cultural reasons why that's the case. But one of the things that people are missing, so they have on the side of the bar graph this enormous, you know, men are smarter than women. If you look at, imagine a bar graph of men to women, and let's say intelligence, even though intelligence isn't the greatest measure, but it's going to get us back to these spontaneous abortions in an interesting conversation. So what people fail to argue when they talk about men are smarter than women is the other end of that bell graph. The other end of that bell graph is we actually see exponentially more mental illness, mental disability problems, different types of autism spectrum, Asperger's spectrum disorders on males than females. So on both sides of the male Belgraph, we see these really long, kind of low metrics where there's a lot of men who are, you know, smarter than a lot of women and a lot of men who are much, much, much arguably dumber than a lot of women. But the bell graph's kind of flat. What we see with women is just a very shorter but taller bell graph where we don't see as many cases of, let's say, high-rated math geniuses. But we also don't see many cases of mental illness, mental disorder. So that's just another metric of showing that to be born, you know, to actually make it through the pregnancy process, female fetuses have to be at a certain level in order to be born. And that's really due to our reproductive strategy, which is we have to have high quality eggs. And then after that, we have such a limited capacity, such a limited number of those eggs. I mean, you would argue most of us don't have, you know, 14 kids anymore. So you would argue it's not that limited, but it is still a limited capacity. And so women have a lot more incentive to choose judiciously who they mate with if they have the choice, right? In order to only invest in high quality partners. And so while men are kind of pursuing quantity, women are pursuing quality. And so that's one of the reasons why we see so many exaggerated male characteristics in a lot of species to attract women in order to mate with them. And so this is something, again, that, you know, we could argue and look at evolutionary history from a totally different perspective of female choice and females as a limiting and controlling factor in evolutionary history. So that's a, you know, an important side note. The other thing we were beginning to talk about on this topic is kind of that battle between the maternal loving mother and kind of the self-protecting, you know, energetically healthy mother. So what happens when you get pregnant is there's a battle that takes place between fetus and mother the entire pregnancy process. So the and throughout, and I think some mothers will hear this and be like, yes, and throughout the child rearing process. So there's this battle of the infant wanting to get all of its needs met at the maximum amount of energetic cost toward their development, and the battle of the female of how can I sustain my own energetic needs, not only for myself, but for future offspring, while still giving this infant what it needs. And so there's this constant allocation of resource back and forth that happens even in the womb. And there's some interesting case studies with that. Once birth occurs, we see a similar process. In fact, there's a really controversial argument in anthropology about, you know, maternal grieving practices. And this was first argued by Nancy Shepherd Hughes about the favelas in Brazil. And one of her arguments is that poor women are losing their infants at such a high rate that they're not really grieving them. Versus, let's say, a first world country where a woman loses a child to death. And it was really controversial because people were angry at her that she would think one woman's grief at the loss of birth was less hard than some rich white lady's loss. And so there is, you know, a lot of weight to that side. On the other side of the spectrum, if we look at kind of energetic costs, we see a lot of women who, you know, we see, there's a great book called Dancing Skeletons, where this argument by Catherine Detweiler about West African malnutrition, where this argument is made again, where we see these women in these, you know, conditions where there's really low access to a lot of good nourishment, a lot of material resources. And we see lots of deaths, lots of child loss. And without a lot of ability to control when and how many children are conceived in birth without family planning. And so we see women basically investing as a strategy in the babies that are signaling or communicating that they're healthy or able to be strong. And we see this almost as if the battle is taking place in the womb continues to take place outside of the womb, which is that, you know, mothers only have so many resources, and so they're going to invest those resources in the offspring that show the most promise. And it's a terrible thing to expect for anyone to, you know, choose one child or another, or invest in their future child over a child that's sick today. But it is also kind of that battle that's taking place from the moment of conception that women will constantly face throughout their lifetime, you know, well, at least throughout our history before 1950s when we invented the pill and a lot of birth control practices, between current health, my health, energetic costs, should I invest in future offspring or the current offspring, etc. So these types of resource allocations are constantly being weighed back and forth, back and forth. And that's something in our history that we just do not see this type of battle taking place in the male spectrum at all. You know, we see some arguments about meat for sex hypotheses. We see some arguments about paternal investment and certain adaptations that would increase paternal investment. But the degree of that battle from physiological all the way to parental investment is nowhere near the same in the male. You know, we don't see a paternal offspring conflict in the same way. So that's an interesting type of unique factor that females are dealing with. Just something like a side note as we're talking about, you know, birth and fertility and evolution. In recent years, one of the neatest findings, I think, that we're discovering lots of new and exciting factors is in epigenetics. What's fascinating about epigenetics is we're discovering that there are certain types of behaviors or conditions that can actually turn on or turn off different gene expressions. And let me explain that a little bit. So there are certain enzymes that are able to unwind your DNA, you know, that's tightly wrapped and then wrapped around histones. And then, you know, take certain enzymes to unwrap that DNA, which can then be, you know, transcribed and translated and replicated. And so in periods of really high stress, it actually inhibits those genes. And that would make sense, right, from an evolutionary perspective, that your body doesn't actually have time to for DNA synthesis and processing or protein processing, you could argue, or the creation of amino acids when you're dealing with the heightened stress situation, that a lot of that energetic cost would go toward, you know, cardiovascular and, you know, muscular motor development or something, or motor capacity, let's say, to flee or fight a situation. So in periods of high stress, we're not seeing these enzymes develop. But what happens in an early, you know, offspring, is that offspring are experiencing this high stress at a really increased or prolonged state, those enzymes will never develop. And those DNA codes will never be expressed. And so you can actually have the genetic DNA and not express them. And that's what makes epigenetics so interesting, is the environmental conditions determine the expression of certain genes. And why I'm bringing this up for pregnancy is there's a couple of really fascinating studies of late that deal specifically with pregnancy and gender and affects women uniquely. So one of those studies is that because the history of our ancestors, which often lived in what we call feast and famine societies, meaning during certain times of the year, there was a lot of food, a lot of resources available. And during other times of the year, it was a famine. There wasn't a lot available. And when we kind of map out some primate fertility rates, we see that it actually fluctuates depending on these feast or famine cycles. So, of course, not all babies are born perfectly in the feast times of the month. But we do see an increase. More babies are born during these times where there's lots of resources. But the babies that aren't still have to find evolutionary strategies to survive. And so there's different types of epigenetic codes that you can, if signal to a baby that, hey, I'm being born in a time of famine. And if I turn off these codes, right, I lessen my metabolism. I increase my, you know, my you know, ability to keep fat, right? To retain fat. I'm going to survive at a higher rate during these famine periods. But fast forward, you know, to our generation, and what signaled feast or famine was the intake that a mother was eating, right? Oh, she's eating a lot. There's plenty of food. There's no periods of fasting or starvation. Great. I signaled to my infant that I'm being born at a time of feast. But what happens nowadays is that a lot of women don't know they're pregnant for the first, you know, week or so, but usually the most critical period is the first 4 days. And during that period, let's say the average woman eats, you know, Diet Coke and a couple Twinkies and some alcohol and some pizzas. So much of that food is not processed as food or recognized by our Stone Age, you know, Pleistocene bodies as food. And so during those first 4 days of pregnancy, we might inadvertently be communicating to our infants, hey, you're going to be born in a time of famine. And what this has led to, a lot of researchers argue, is the childhood obesity crisis that we're seeing today around the world, is that we're signaling these epigenetic codes of, oh my goodness, you're going to be born at a time of famine. And so our children are being born with high retention of fat, low metabolism, as an evolutionary strategy, and now it's becoming maladaptive. So that's an interesting one. Another one that they found was that we see some epigenetic holdovers that occur in the grandchildren of women who smoked during pregnancy. And that takes a minute to wrap your head around. But women who smoke during pregnancy, we know that smoking does affect a fetus. We see some effect on fetuses, but we expect that it's a direct relationship. But what we forget, again, is that female fetuses are born with all of their eggs. And so those eggs are also affected by that smoking. And so we actually see grandchildren affected by the behavior of their grandmothers during pregnancy. And that's a really fascinating type of relationship, again, that we're seeing these enormous and very critical, important shifts taking place in not only the female, genetic relationship, but in the behaviors that a woman chooses throughout her life and pregnancy that are affecting children and grandchildren. We're not seeing the same type of direct relationship in these critical periods with males. And so, again, it's another one of those cases of how critical and important and fascinating the relationship between women and offspring and evolution is, and how little it's talked about in evolutionary theory compared to, man the hunter and man the kind of progenitor of evolution, which is quite fascinating. This gets into more of what I do, what I study, what I'm an expert at, not just kind of 101, let's talk about these things. And this is what I think is fascinating, and I kind of want to talk you through it. The thing that I do, which is called social susceptibility, and this gets us to females in a way that really is fascinating to me. So I want to talk kind of as social groupings arose and got bigger and bigger, there's some positive things that happen, and there's some negative things that happen. So there's pros and cons to group living. Some of the negatives to group living are there's way increase of competitiveness. There's, people fighting for, of one food source. So there's a lot more infighting. There's greater increase of disease being spread. There's greater, there's just greater competition, like intergroup aggression, more competition for mates, more competition for resources. These cause a lot of costs with physical altercations. This, creates a lot of wounds just from fighting or dominance competitions, let's see. So the larger your group is, the more likely that other people in your group will try to kind of take your food or take your mate or kind of basically manipulate, use, and abuse you, right? But there's also all these positive things, right? With greater group size, you can see increased cooperation. People often think of human evolution and think about like Nazi Germany and eugenics and survival of the fittest. But really, the history of evolution is a lot about cooperation, and that gets us to the mother-infant bond. That so much of how we interact with one another, it is based on this back and forth between, you have to weigh these very subtle social cues. So I, as an individual, my survival goes up if I can gain lots of access to resources, if I can have, protection from others in my group, if when I'm sick, I know someone has my back and will give me mutual aid. So my survival radically increases the stronger my connections are to other people and my access to resources, not only my own, but other people's as well that are willing to give it to me. And what that requires is not this kind of selfish individual, I'm going to take over the world personality, which some people sometimes argue. It's kind of the narcissistic male leader version of who is successful in society as a dominant individual. But really what we're seeing is what makes a dominant individual is their ability to influence others, their ability to gain allies, their ability to access, defend, and keep resources. And they can't do that alone. No individual can do that alone, especially in a human society with large groups. It requires really strong social skills to kind of form alliances with other people. And so it's really important that we begin to see like how important social acuity is in human evolution, that that's what makes you a dominant individual. That's what allows you to be protected in times of vulnerability, is having really strong people around you. And we call this, you know, there's sexual selection, there's natural selection, and a more modern phrase is social selection. The people who were able to gain the greatest amount of allies actually survived and reproduced at higher rates because they were protected in times of injury or vulnerability, and they were able to kind of influence people into actions that were beneficial for themselves and for others, because you wouldn't retain those kind of trust alliances if you were only doing things that were good for yourself. So one of the things I definitely like to highlight if we're talking about feminist evolutionary theory is just this idea of like the solitary leader that's dominant and violent and you know, gets his way. And I think we spread this idea because a lot of the dominant structures we're looking at are, like things like the great, like gorillas, let's say, where you do have a dominant individual that kind of occupies and controls a large harem. And if, you know, a new dominant male comes in, there's a lot of cases of something like infanticide, right? So that the women of his harem can now produce his offspring and not the one before him. And so we do get this kind of solitarily male leader interpretation, as well as just holdovers from survival of the fittest and eugenic theory. But in all reality, that's really not the main impetus of some of the main factors or components driving natural selection. What we see instead is more of a cooperative species, a species that, you know, has a lot of friends and alliances, people who, you know, are reciprocal with one another. And there's a lot of reciprocity studies. But you know, one of the greatest arguments, I think, is getting to the social intelligence hypothesis, which is basically like the demand. And here's a good quote from Downey and Linday, and they are, you know, neuroanthropologists, kind of bridging the gap between biology and culture. And their argument is basically that the demands and opportunities of being a long-lived, highly social species kind of creates a competition with our own kind, that this increased intelligence is really useful for social problem solving more than for environmental adaptation. And this is not new to Downey and Linday. This is a fascinating argument that I'm sure you'll hear from lots of people, that our brains didn't develop to solve ecological problems. There's many species in similar ecological problems without big brains, right? But what we see is as group size increases, we see a positive correlate with brain size increasing. And that's because in highly social and highly, you know, aggregated species, you're needing to have really high intelligence to go through all these factors, to figure out who's selfish, to figure out who's manipulative, to figure out who's a free rider, to figure out who's on your side. And all of these little things are really complex. And so people who were able to figure out those really basic things were able to survive and reproduce at higher rates than people who were not. And so really the history of modern humans is that those who are more socially intelligent, who understood empathy, fairness, cooperation, you know, tacit communication and caregiving, were actually, you know, had the greatest fitness. And so that's an important way to begin looking at, you know, this. And there's a, you know, the social brain hypothesis is probably, you know, by Dunbar is probably the most famous example of this, where they actually did a lot of statistical testing of group size and human, you know, brain size, and were able to determine that all of this, you know, was scientifically accurate. And what's interesting with all of that is not only, you know, do humans fit that mold, right, that as increased social group size, brain size increases, But we also have what's called a highly encephalized brain, which means that we are even far beyond, we're off the charts. I could show you a chart that's really fascinating in regard to kind of body size to brain size. And we are completely off the charts. Our brains are way bigger to our bodies than even, you know, certain types of social whales and elephants and things that we would think have enormous brains. So our brain to body ratio is really offset. And this again shows how important brain size. And if you go back to the social intelligence and social brain hypotheses, that brain size is a relative to our ability to manipulate, to understand, to adjust and adapt to social elements and of our lives. So it makes us very, very, very responsive to environmental cues and very, you know, susceptible to enculturation. It makes us able to learn quickly. It makes us able to like perceive and adapt to a situation very, very fast. We also have something that's really interesting called spindle nerves, which are only found in really highly social species. And these nerves are interesting because they create a kind of superhighway between our executive functioning and our emotional parts of the brain. And we only see this in highly social species. So again, all of these adaptations are just kind of getting us to understand how important being able to perceive and then respond or react to our environmental conditions is. And why I bring all of that up is because probably the most critical factor in all of evolution is the mother-child relationship. And that is a highly complex back-and-forth relationship with competing interests, right? It's better for a woman to conserve her energy. It's better for her to get sleep. It's better for her to be able to, you know, go gather food sources. But it's better for a baby to get attention, care, constant touch. It's better for a baby to get as much resources as it possibly can from the mother. So there's some competing interests that happen there. And there's an enormous amount of back and forth communication that takes place. So babies have, you know, a lot of adaptations built in, naturally selected, that get you to take care of them. There's a lot of manipulation factor happening here, from crying to the smell of their head to their neotenous, you know, facial features. Babies exhibit a lot of adaptations to say, you know, please take care of me, please take care of me. Because over time, these, you know, increased fitness, babies who had, you know, these types of features or behaviors that compelled other people to take care of them survived and reproduced at higher rates. But none of that would be useful or helpful if mothers weren't able to respond. And there's a, you know, sad but fascinating study done in rats where they actually cut a part of the anterior cingulate cordate. They cut the ACC of rat mothers' brains, which kind of helps them respond or read emotional cues, and they did not pay attention to their rat babies. The distress levels of stress when they heard their infants crying did not rise, and we see a lot less of those babies surviving. And so that's just, you know, one of the examples that so much is built into the female brain as well and body to respond to all of these adaptations of an infant. So not only do infants have, please take care of me, please take care of me, constantly, on the on switch, but we also have, mothers have these constant reactions to baby crying, right? From physiologically like letting down of the milk when you hear a baby crying to instantaneous stress, that distress is only abated when you can get the baby to calm down. And so it's an intention, it's attentional, you know, care. It's, I'm giving you, you know, care in order to meet my need, which is now super stress until I can get you to calm down. So there's all these back and forth, relationships between mother and infant. And I don't want to leave the father out of this, because so often people will sometimes rely on biology to get to essentialist thinking, or they'll say, you know, women evolved to be caregivers and therefore they're supposed to be in the home or whatever. So there are some bad essentialist arguments based on biology. And what's interesting is that we actually see a lot of, you know, not to the same degree as women, but we see a lot of physiological changes and morphological changes happening throughout the history of men as caregivers as well. So from the decreasing of, you know, from the decreasing of sexual dimorphism, which as that sexual dimorphism, you know, becomes more equivalent between males and females, we see greater paternal investment. And so we actually see, you know, just quite a small, you know, 20% sexual dimorphic rate in humans. And so that you argued that one of the reasons for that is greater paternal investment. We also see during the course of a father's, once he becomes a father, we see a big decrease in testosterone, right? We see a lot of physiological changes happening when the father is living in a home with a newborn baby that facilitate his caregiving. So women aren't the only ones manipulated by babies. In fact, one adaptation argued that babies exhibit is a greater resemblance to paternal, you know, facial features at birth that then may, you know, decrease over time, but in order for fathers to invest early on because of hidden ovulation, you know, and the way our species is, men have no assurance of paternity. And so that's one of the arguments in multi-male, multi-female types of, you know, chimpanzee societies is there's no great paternal investment because no one knows exactly who their offspring is. And one of the arguments for marriage or what we call pair bonding is it gives a greater assurance that a paternal investment, and this is another one of those, a resemblance of the father early on. And so anything that can increase paternal investment in the offspring is going to be like a good, you know, adaptation that increases survival. So all of these things are important because it's another, you know, one of the arguments I'm making, another factor of kind of viewing these evolutionary transitions from a female perspective of understanding that conflict from fetus all the way up to child rearing that takes, you know, incredible social intelligence. It takes incredible capacity of emotional intelligence to read, respond, understand, and react, you know, recognize and react appropriately to another's tacit communication. And if we didn't have that, if mothers weren't able to respond appropriately to basically a dependent being that could not communicate, you know, the species, we wouldn't have survived. And, you know, those who were able to have greater frequency of that trait over time. So really the crux of our ability to communicate, our big brains, our ability to understand, you know, tacit social features and micro expressions and to feel empathetic when reading fiction and to get, you know, emotional when listening to certain types of music and just to respond to kind of these socio-emotional cues is actually a leftover from this maternal infant relationship. And of course, that doesn't just go away as we grow up, right? We all continue to exist in a world where our survival is increased if we can continue to get people to care for us, right? And if we can continue to care for others. And so we're constantly going back and forth between this battle of, please take care of me. Please love me. Let me show you that I need your help. And I'm a caregiver. I can give care. You know, you want to be my ally because I have resources to offer. And so we're constantly going back and forth, even, you know, throughout our lifetimes between these types of things. And we're communicating them in very, very subtle ways. And we can talk about that maybe another time of how we communicate, you know, status and how we communicate health and how we communicate need, and what we get out of that when we do it appropriately and what happens when we don't. And so again, it's another one of these things that talks about, you know, the female. Often when we talk about, you know, male, you know, spatial and math ability versus female verbal and social ability. We kind of sublimate the female end of that spectrum because in modern society, you know, of test taking and the way our corporate, you know, and career structures are based, there are certain benefits that you achieve from more of the masculine brain type of thinking or skill set than the female brain type of thinking and skill set. And not that these are essentialist traits. I don't want to go into essentialism, but I want us to really focus for a second on how much of human evolution in particular is dependent on these very acute abilities to pick up on socio and emotional intelligence cues. And to take that kind of more seriously and to understand why those are so strong in females, particularly have a lot to do with the ability to read and understand infants and respond appropriately to their signals. So I find that highly fascinating. And it's also, you know, and this is kind of maybe the last thing I'll say. I could talk for hours. Clearly, I apologize. I'm kind of long-winded. Why I find this so fascinating kind of as we just get like maybe like a so what? So why is this important? Why do we care about this? Why do we even care? For me, it's important because our ability to be susceptible to one another, to read one another and respond, basically the trade-off is that it leaves us vulnerable to each other. So I am born with and I'm very good at, you know, scouring a room and reading people's facial expressions and making sure that I'm doing whatever I need to do that helps me fit in the group and not get kicked out and helps me, you know, have a roof over my head and food in my belly and gives me good friends that have my back if something bad happens. And at the same time, that ability to read an environment and respond also makes me susceptible to being in a situation where I am ostracized or rejected or looked down upon or where there's a great inequality and I have low status in my body and my mind, you know, psychologically and physiologically. I'm going to adapt and respond to that as well. And the final takeaway from my research in relation to kind of the things we've been talking about is I think it's important for everyone to understand where that ability to perceive and respond comes from and that it's an adaptation, that it's a good thing, and just realize that as our societies become more intense, more globalized, as we, you know, increase our social circle to not only include, you know, our families, but now, you know, enormous populations of social media friends and, you know, think of how big the high school was that you graduated in versus what your grandmother graduated in. So our social circles are rapidly expanding and we're constantly responding to things at a degree that our brains and bodies were never meant to respond to. And so we have this overload and that again is, it helped us survive at one point, but now can make us this sensitivity to social and emotional cues can make us very sensitive, let's say, to something like bullying, can make us very sensitive to something, you know, like being ostracized from, let's say, a religious group. It can make us very, very sensitive to not quite fitting in. And so a lot of what I would argue, the social pain that is so rampant in our cultures today is basically the consequence of these great superpowers that we have of reading and perceiving our environment. So it's a trade-off of both really awesome, great skills that we have and, you know, really big vulnerabilities that we share with each other. And so really every day we kind of are at the mercy of the people around us, to keep us mentally and physically healthy and to help us, you know, belong and feel good. And so I think that's really fascinating, that kind of constant battle and cooperation that we necessitate from one another.
Well, Chelsea, that was incredibly fascinating. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Stay tuned for another episode of Story of Woman, where we talk more about the evolution of human beings. This episode you just listened to is produced by Lindsay Hanson Park, co-produced by Grace Boole, who also contributed to some of the writing. The music was provided by this great band, Lady Murasaki, and you can check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com.
If you like what you hear, check out more podcasts at storyofwoman.org, where there's a link to other podcasts that I have done.